I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Welcome to Monsters Among Us. I am your guide, Derek Hayes. Well, it's official. Fall is here. I can tell you it's about 50 degrees, a little bit rainy, and the leaves are starting to change colors here. I can't tell you how excited I am about all that. Now, I have a great show lined up for you guys this evening, but before we get started, I have to do this. Today is Addie Lloyd's birthday. And for those of you that don't know who Addie is, she is the awesome Facebook moderator over at the group page. I want each and every one of you to go follow the page and then take the time out to wish Addie a happy birthday. Let's blow this page up. I want to thank Addie and Warren, while I'm at it, for all their hard work and dedication for the show. I know I say it every week, but that's how much it means to me. So happy birthday, Addie. I hope it's a great one. As I said, I have one heck of a show lined up for you guys this evening. And you know me, I like to get right into it. So tonight's first call comes to us from a distant land. The following is Stuart's call from England.
Hi, Monsters Among Us. It's Stuart here, calling all the way from Oxford in England. My story actually comes to you through my father, who recounted his creepy experiences to me when he was a child. He said this: I must have been about 10 or 11 years old when I had the weirdest experiences. In 1957, my mother and I were living with a close friend who lived in a beautiful Tudor house in the middle of the New Forest in the south of England. Reputedly, this had been lived in for a while by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, famous amongst other things for having written Sherlock Holmes stories. We'd been told that his ghost was actually a frequent visitor. One summer's afternoon, I and one of our host's sons were playing in the garden. Everyone else was out, that was for sure. All of a sudden, we heard very loud noises coming from the playroom. We went upstairs to investigate. As we got nearer the doors, the volume increased. It sounded as if someone was chucking stuff around and pulling books off the shelves. When we opened the door, however, it was completely silent and not a thing was out of place. But what really struck us was the temperature in the room. It was utterly freezing. We scuttled downstairs pretty quickly and incredibly frightened. Another day, from the same room, again, when everyone was out, we heard what sounded like little children playing with a toy train in the room. Again, we approached the room, still hearing what sounded like kids having a great time, only to open the door and again be met with a silent and still room that was bitterly cold. I remember it this vividly as if it was yesterday. On another occasion, my mother came out of her bedroom and saw, at the end of a very long landing, a figure dressed in old-fashioned clothes. She also noticed that it seemed to be floating above the ground by a few inches. Don't worry, she was told. That's Sir Arthur searching for his diary. Now, as I wasn't there, I can't give you much more detail, but this comes directly from my father, who's an avid skeptic of paranormal activity. He, however, swears blind that the house was haunted and that the experiences were real, with no real logical explanation. I, in fact, visited the house in the late 90s and can attest to its spooky feeling based on how old it was, but I never actually saw anything myself. I'd love to know what you think of the story and whether anyone else who listened has had any similar experiences or even visited this house in the New Forest. As always, keep up the great work of this podcast and all the very best from the UK.
Thank you, Stuart, for calling in long distance. Now, the first thing I will note is that if anyone else out there happens to have a third or second-hand story, don't hesitate to call that story in. Some of our best tales to date have been second-hand stories. Just be sure to get as many details as possible. Now for the activity itself. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a noted spiritualist. I believe, now this is going unresearched, I believe he lost his son at an early age, and that caused him to delve deep into the spiritualist movement of the time in an attempt to reach his deceased son. So perhaps there is some sort of link to the house. Is it possible that Doyle himself performed seances in the home? Is this enough to build that connection? Of course, this is all speculative, but it's awfully fun to think about. Thank you again, Stuart, for taking the time to share the call. Our next call comes to us from the state of Georgia. The following is Matt's call.
Hi, yeah, my name's Matt from Atlanta. I've always really been interested in paranormal stuff, but never really experienced anything until I moved to southeastern Tennessee. It's pretty much on the tri-state area of northeast Georgia, southeast Tennessee, and southwest North Carolina. There's an area out there called Copper Hill that's known for having lights in the sky. You know, UFOs, whether it be alien or government, yet to be seen. But I know a lot of people that really don't deal with nonsense too much, and they've told me stories of crazy stuff they've seen. And I myself have seen stuff. Now, I've always been interested in paranormal, but I've always tried to be as skeptic as possible. But I'm going to share three quick stories that I experienced in my time. The first being one time I was hiking and camping over a spot called Jacks River Falls in northeast Georgia. It's way out in the middle of nowhere. It's an hour and a half drive and then a 2 to 3 hour hike to get out there, so it's really out there. A really beautiful spot. You can see all the stars. Me and a friend of mine were sitting on a rock checking out the sky for a few hours and just, you know, enjoying nature. And all of a sudden we saw what looked like three satellites moving in tandem with each other. And then suddenly the one on the top and the one on the bottom started zigzagging. And then for probably about 5-10 seconds, and then both shot off. And during this time, I hadn't said anything, but my friend had mentioned with, oh, are you seeing this? And then after they shot off, the middle one kept going straight, and then about 2 or 3 seconds later did the same thing. Now, I've done a bunch of research into what I saw, and I've seen some explanations, but really nothing to the level to explain exactly what I saw. So that was pretty fun to see. The second being, me and my friends went out and did a midnight hike up to the top of a mountain where there's something called an amphitheater. And basically, you can see out for miles and miles on top of this mountain down into the valley. And right across from the amphitheater, after we've been out there for like 15, 20 minutes, we saw a green light. Now, I know that green light has been associated with drones, but this thing was way too large to be a drone. They think something about the size of a helicopter at least. And a green light shining way far away, at least 5 to 10 miles away across this valley. And it's right above the mountain line and it's coming straight at us. So for the first, you know, 5-10 minutes when we see that, like, oh, what is that? Oh, it's a helicopter, you know, not really too worried about it. And it keeps coming at us slowly, slowly, slowly. This is over the course of about 30, 45 minutes until, you know, we start, the girls kind of get a little scared. I'm honestly kind of scared because you're like, what is this light coming straight at us? So eventually it just right above us. And at that point, it completely disappears from view. It doesn't keep moving. As soon as it goes above us, it disappears. We didn't have any time loss or anything like that, so don't think we were abducted or anything insane like that, but just a very strange light in the sky that I saw. The third, I was at a wedding party in the mountains with a bunch of my friends, and it was at night, you know, after a long night. Now, we were all imbibed, but it would take a lot to have a group hallucination. So a few of my friends had been seeing this light, and it was just flashing and staying at the same height above the mountain. Now, we all thought that it was from a telephone tower. At least that's what I thought, but I swore it wasn't. And so we had seen it there for about 2 or 3 hours, pretty much since the sun went down. Then all of a sudden, we see it slowly float away, almost like a balloon. Now, was it a weather balloon? I don't know. Just another something weird I saw. But yeah, just wanted to share the quick few stories I saw out in that wilderness. Yeah, keep on keeping on. Great podcast. Thanks.
Thank you, Matt. Let me start off by saying this. Satellites are quite often confused for UFOs. But there's one thing we need to remember. Satellites have a trajectory. They travel in one straight motion. They never change that trajectory, and they certainly never veer off. So what Matt saw that night was most likely not a satellite. However, it is possible that it was a high-altitude aircraft, or, in this case, several high-altitude aircrafts. Perhaps they were launched from the same location, and midway through their flight, veered off in different trajectories to meet up with their destination. Now, this is simply a theory. I am not a military aircraft expert, but I do know that there are several planes that have the ability to travel at very high altitudes. Now, as for Matt's second story, in my opinion, this could easily have been just a helicopter. Perhaps it was too far away to hear the roar of the engine. And that green light he spoke of, I happen to know that when helicopters travel at night, there's usually a cab light on that's tinted to help preserve night vision. Now, typically that color is red, but I suppose green would be just as effective. So it's possible that what Matt saw was simply a helicopter with a cab light. But then again, I wasn't there, and that sounds awfully easy to identify. But it's Matt's third story that really jogged my memory. Several years ago, two friends and I went backpacking in the San Gabriel Mountains of Southern California. We trekked about, I'd say, 10 to 12 miles back into the mountains, not a light in sight, and not a person in sight. We set up camp that evening, and to our surprise, the sky was alive. You could see every star, most of the planets, shooting stars, satellites, you name it, you can see it. And at a certain point, we began to see a faint, white flashing light coming from the opposite ridge. Now, our first thought was that this was simply a cell phone tower with a white flashing indicator on the top. But given our location and the altitude, we were probably, I'd say, at close to 10,000 feet and had no service whatsoever. I would say that this most likely was not a cell phone tower. And in fact, if it was, it would have had to have been the largest tower ever created because it lit up literally half of the sky. Now, this light would flash every 3 to 4 seconds, and we never did seem to find a source to it. And I just couldn't help but notice the similarities between Matt's experience and what me and my friends experienced several years ago. Thank you again, Matt, for taking the time to share this information. Our next call, coincidentally, also comes from that same area. The following call is Antonio's from Oregon.
Hey, guys. My name is Antonio. Originally from California, living in Staten, Oregon currently right now. This story takes place in 2006. I was about 19 at the time. I was camping by myself up in Azusa Canyon in East Fork area. There's an area called the Bridge to Nowhere. And if you go a little further back, about 7 miles in, it's called Fisherman's Hook. This place has like a place where people can bungee jump, and about 4:30, 5 o'clock, everyone kind of clears out. It starts getting dark unless you're going to camp out that way. And so I was camping by myself. I want to say it was rather clear night, a little cloud cover, but nothing too crazy. I've been camping my entire life. I've been coyote hunting, so I know animals pretty well. We're out that way. We have a small bear, black bear population out that way, and some bobcats and mountain lion, but you never really see or hear the mountain lions at all. I want to say it's probably about 8:30, finished cooking dinner. I cleaned up, got ready to turn in for the night at my tent. And about 10:30, I got just the overwhelming feeling that I needed to get up and look outside. I don't know, I've never really had that feeling before. So I get up, check on the fire, it's out. I don't know what's really going on, but I still feel really uneasy. And I get outside of the tent and I walk probably about 40 yards from my tent to relieve myself. And finish up, start heading back to the tent, not feeling a little better, maybe, I don't know. I was just about myself or what was going on, but I didn't feel too nervous anymore. And I start walking, and just as I start to unzip the tent to get back in, I hear the scariest thing I've ever heard in my life. Probably lasted about 20, 25 seconds. I mean, it was deep. I mean, it filled the entire canyon. But it didn't seem so far away, but it's hard telling with being in a canyon, you know, exactly where it came from. But it was the loudest sound I've ever heard in my life. It was deep and it was scary. It definitely wasn't a coyote, and it was no mountain lion that I've ever heard. I've heard mountain lions in heat, and I mean, they're scary on their own, but this was scary. It was very deep. It was different from anything I've ever heard. If anyone knows of what this was or could have been, but it was loud. It was the biggest sound I've ever heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Antonio. Now, I've spent a lot of time in this area, and in fact, I've hiked this hike that Antonio was talking about several times. And basically, what he's describing is exactly what it is. It's a 10-mile footpath to a steel bridge that spans the distance of the San Gabriel River. Now, originally, there was a road planned to meet up with the bridge, but due to tax reasons, that road was never completed. So as it stands now, there's simply a bridge in the middle of nowhere. Now, this area, despite the fact that it's used recreationally quite often, is somewhat dangerous. You have the rushing river of the San Gabriel. You have mountain lions, bear, rattlesnakes, scorpions, in addition to high walls, loose rocks, you name it. This place is not for the faint of heart. So to me, it seems kind of crazy that in the middle of the night, someone would be out pranking campers. It just doesn't seem to be a very smart move. Now, as for the sound that Antonio heard that evening, my first thought was that he simply heard a big cat in heat. Either it'd be a bobcat or a mountain lion. I've played the sounds on here before, and I can tell you, they're downright terrifying. But as Antonio described, he seemed to be a bit of a seasoned outdoorsman, so I find it hard to believe he wouldn't recognize that sound. His story did, however, remind me of a video I saw on YouTube several years ago, a somewhat infamous video. The following audio was recorded on October 22nd of 2007 in Sequoia National Park here in California. The audio details strange screaming sounds heard by the hikers that day. Check this out.
Very strange noise. Seems to be coming from some kind of an animal. It's been going on for about a minute now. Coming from the east. be getting closer.
Now, there were also some structure discoveries and even a sighting on the ridge above them, but we'll save that for another day. Now, I'm not sure what it is that Antonio heard that evening, but I can tell you this. If it spooks a seasoned outdoorsman, then you know it's got to be something substantial. Thank you again, Antonio, for sharing the call. Now, as I said in the opener, I have a bit of a surprise for you guys this evening. But before we get to that, a few announcements. I'm currently working on restocking the shop. You guys are buying stuff faster than I can keep it on the shelves, which I truly, truly appreciate. But if there's something there you'd like to see that doesn't exist, please just shoot me an email or send me a message on Facebook asking. You never know, it may be something that I can easily include in the shop. The rates and reviews are flying in, and I truly, truly appreciate that. But let's not stop there. If you enjoy the show and you have not yet left a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or on iTunes or anywhere that you listen to your podcast, please do so now. A 5-star review and a few quick words about why you enjoy the show goes a long way to help us grow our audience. So your 30-second contribution could help grow our numbers by dozens. And lastly, the holidays are right around the corner. So if you're looking for the perfect gift for that cryptid fan in your life, why don't you consider Cryptid Crate? Cryptid Crate is the first and only monthly box subscription service for fans of cryptozoology. Each month, you get a carefully curated crate filled with all kinds of monstrous goodies, from t-shirts to hats to books, DVDs, and collectibles. Cryptid Crate offers two levels. For $40, you get the main crate, which is valued at around $80 per month. And for $20, you get Cryptid Crate Lite, which is valued at around $40 a month. Shipping is free to the U.S., and gift subscriptions are available on the website. So visit CryptidCrate.com to pick up your order today. Okay, now for that surprise. I'm going to preface this surprise with the following submission from listener Mark. The Noshoba Chito, or the Dog Man. The story of the Noshoba Chito, wolf spirit or big man, begins long ago with the Choctaw Indians. It was said that at one time Sasquatch was a killer, a cannibal, and a thief. Many tribes were at war with these beings because they would steal women and children, murder horses, and kill the warriors. The chief of the Chata, the Choctaw, called for a great gathering of as many tribes as possible to combat the Bigfoot tribes. Word was sent far and wide, and many tribes came with their medicine men and women and best warriors to the gathering. It was discussed what should be done to stop these attacks by the Bigfoots. Spears and guns and arrows were having no effect, so the medicine men came up with a plan that involved black magic. They would create a small army of warriors to fight the Bigfoots, but they would have to be transformed into something beyond human strength. So they decided to turn these men into wolfmen, big and ferocious, like werewolves. They picked the best warriors and did the spell one evening at a powwow. Once transformed into the wolf-type men, they set out to track the Bigfoot down. And the great battle was fought. Many Bigfoot and wolfmen were killed, but the spell worked. The Bigfoot left the people alone after that, but there was a new problem. These wolfmen were created to kill, and the people were terrified of them, and they were causing trouble in the tribes. So the medicine men met again to decide what to do about the wolfmen. They decided that they had to kill them now also. So they made a plan to set them up. The medicine men invited the wolfmen on a hunt, and they agreed. Once in the forest, they led the wolfmen into a thicket and set it on fire. But the wolfmen escaped the trap and were furious at them for tricking them, and they vowed to kill all the people they could for this betrayal. The people were terrified, so they cried out in ceremony to the Great Spirit to help them, and he responded. God was angry with the people, but he said he would not kill the Noshoba Chito because they were men first, who were turned into abominations by the use of magic. But he agreed he would help the people. The Great Spirit went before the Noshoba and the Bigfoot elders and told them he would not wipe their kind from the earth if they agreed to never kill man again. They agreed. So they were allowed to live on, and in return, God told Bigfoot and the Noshoba that he would give them a second earth where they could hide from man and to bury their dead. God told the tribes that this would serve as a lesson that magic such as this should never be used, and to trust him instead. So that is the basic story of the Dogmen. Since the time of old tales, it is now believed the Bigfoot and Noshiba have evolved together. The Bigfoot is king of the land, so they allow the Noshiba to watch over territory and over the babies. But there is an uneasy truce still, and it is said that they still fight sometimes and kill each other. The Noshiba are from the spiritual realm. They are interdimensional and reside in that second earth, and most times stay close to the reservations and sacred Indian burial grounds. They do not reproduce like the Bigfoot and can't be killed by humans' guns. That's the story of how the Dogman came to be. The world is ever-changing, and this show is no different. In order to keep things fresh and interesting, I've decided to include a short little interview, maybe once a month or so. And tonight is the first episode to feature one of these interviews. You may know tonight's guest from Sasquatch Podcast, but you probably recognize him from the Small Town Monsters documentary series. His most recent film, The Bray Road Beast, drops tomorrow. So please welcome director Seth Breedlove to the program. Welcome to the show, Seth. How you doing?
I'm great. I'm tired. We went out for a birthday celebration tonight because my birthday's next week, but I'm going to be gone, and I'm recuperating from the Sunday I ate for dinner.
Well, happy birthday in advance. I didn't realize your birthday was coming up.
Yeah, it's not until the 10th, but we're going to be somewhere in New York, in the middle of nowhere in New York. So this was like our date night, you know.
So I brought you on the show today you have a new DVD coming out, on the 5th, is that correct?
Yeah, it comes out Friday.
So it's the day after this episode airs. We're recording this on Wednesday. So I wanted to bring you on, and I love this film. It's my favorite cryptid. And I wanted to bring you on and have a little discussion about some behind-the-scenes stuff and, you know, just some more insight on what was going on. And hopefully we can convince a few people to check out the film, because it's definitely worth you doing so.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm glad you liked it. We're pretty confident this is, in terms of quality, this is, our best movie. But we're also very, I think everyone on the crew is kind of anxious to see what the response is going to be like. And, if it sort of busts out of the little small town monsters bubble and can find some, a larger audience, or if it's kind of maintain where we've been at for the last, 2 years. It's interesting because, our movies tend to, they have a really wide audience reaction, but there's when Mothman came out, when the Mothman of Point Pleasant came out, it kind of burst out of the small town monsters bubble, and we've been waiting for the next film that would do that. And we all kind of have a sense that this could be that sort of movie. It's just going to be, I think it's going to be down to word of mouth, honestly, because we don't have $1 million marketing budget. So we're kind of relying on other people telling their friends about it.
And, that's part of what the paranormal community is about, is, lifting other people and sharing other people's work and, that kind of thing. That's definitely something that I try to do, especially with Cryptid Crate and stuff like that. And that's also why I decided to have you on today to, kind of give you a soapbox so that some people that may otherwise never hear of the documentary can get a chance to check it out. Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you a quick question. What is the determining factor in escaping the small town monsters bubble that you spoke of? Now, it sounds like to me you have a monster like Mothman. Everybody knows who Mothman is. I mean, there's a meme going around right now about Moth and Mothman, all this stuff. Is it based on the monster? Is it based on the execution of the documentary? Is it based on the geographical location? What are the factors, in your opinion, as far as, what gets you out of that space?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because we eventually, our movies tend to find their way to Amazon Prime, and it'd be sort of a free viewing for Amazon Prime customers. And at that point, they all sort of burst onto this much larger scale audience. We've had 3.5 million views on Amazon since we went up back in 2016. So the growth has been exponential, but for Mothman, it was on a completely different level. And I think that really does just come down to the fact that, to me, and I just got in an argument with Lauren Coleman about this last weekend, to me, the Mothman is the most popular cryptid right now, or at least the most culturally recognized right now. You know, there seems to be like a real following for Mothman as a character. So I understand that Bigfoot is sort of the one that everyone thinks of, but I also believe that there's a growing interest in something like the Mothman. So I really do, you know, like there is a certain level of recognition that comes with something like Bigfoot, but our movies aren't typically called, or they've never been called, you know, like Bigfoot or anything like that. We've got On the Trail of Bigfoot coming out next year, but you know, they're all regional titles. So it's Boggy Creek Monster and Beast Whitehall. And the weird thing about that is the movies that have hit on a massive scale commercially for us are not the ones you would probably think they are. Like Beast of Whitehall was massive for us. Probably, in terms of like profit and the amount of money that went into it versus what was earned, it's by far our most successful movie, which is kind of crazy because it was, you know, it was made for like $600. And for some reason, that movie found a very large audience. And, you know, we were getting, when that movie came out on Amazon, we were contacted by Amazon's acquisition department because they wanted to help promote it because it was doing so well.
Wow.
So that one really took off. And then the other one would have been Invasion on Chestnut Ridge. That one actually had a very successful opening when it first came out. And beyond that, you know, the Mothman, obviously, and everything else is kind of existing sort of right below those two.
Well, speaking of your films, the latest one, The Bray Road Beast. I got that title right, didn't I?
You did.
I always want to say it the other way around.
Yeah, I know. Congratulations on that. It's been like the biggest, for some reason, it has been like a big detraction for a lot of people, is the fact that the movie isn't called The Beast of Bray Road. And I keep having to get to like explain to people that there was this terrible, terrible horror movie in the very early 2000s.
I've seen it.
Called The Beast of Bray Road. Yeah, I own it. And, you know, like we wanted to separate ourselves from that and at least, you know, make it so we didn't have a movie with the exact same title as a terrible Asylum era sci-fi movie.
Well, I also like that you mix it up a little bit. It's just when you say it out loud for the first time, it's difficult to not go to The Beast of Bray Road, which is, you know, such a common phrase to say.
A number of the reviews have just gone ahead and called it The Beast of Bray Road. So I'm confident no matter what, people will figure it out.
As long as they get the DVDs in their hands, I guess that's all that matters, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, speaking of the film, the opening sequence to this movie, I've got to talk to you a moment about this. And for those that haven't seen it yet, it opens, I suppose, like a Hammer horror film, in the aspect that there's a storybook, there's candles, there's like hints of like witchcraft or you know, some sort of occultism going on. It the way it was done is phenomenal. The lighting's perfect. The score by Brandon was amazing. What was the inspiration behind all of that?
We had a sit down meeting last year. Man, I can't even remember. It would have been shortly after we had worked with Santino on Flatwoods. And I had this discussion about Hammer horror kind of being the big inspiration behind the style and sort of the visuals in this movie. So I wanted like these really deep reds and kind of, you know, like probably overly saturated somewhat and stuff like that. And it didn't, the final product doesn't necessarily have what we originally discussed, but it did maintain the opening, which was this sort of storybook opening that would lead into the first sort of werewolf myth, which is, you know, like Aeon and Zeus and all that stuff. That was always how we were going to open the movie. The book sort of opening and all that was partly Santino's idea and sort of born out of my idea of keeping this sort of rooted in that Hammer horror style. And I have to say, like, that entire opening sequence was sort of constructed by Santino Vitale. He actually built that wall, built the window, behind the window was a green screen, and that's how the sky and everything kind of came to be in that shot. But I could show you the behind the scenes photos and stuff of that, and it's pretty crazy. He built the book, built the whole set for that opening shot. So, you know, like the lion's share of the credit on that sequence goes to Santino. And it really is like a really awesome way to open the movie. And I got to show this movie to Adam Wingard back in July. And Adam directs these, you know, fairly large budgeted movies now compared to what we're doing. He's currently like making that new King Kong versus Godzilla, which is like a $300 million budget.
Just a small film, right?
Yeah. And he was actually blown away by the opening of this one too, and was like, his statement was that it like immediately makes you feel like you're watching a Hollywood production rather than, you know, like a small scale independent film. And I have no problem with like it being a small scale independent film, but if we can attain something that approaches the sort of like Hollywood level production values, that's fantastic for us.
Yeah. Now, I've seen every one of your films, and I enjoy every one of them. But when this one started, I remember watching it in the hotel room at Crypticon. You'd slip me a copy. I think it was Friday evening, and I couldn't wait to get upstairs. I skipped a couple things to go watch it. And that opening intro, I sat up. I'm like, man, he's really stepped up his game on this one. That shot where it comes through the window, and for those that haven't seen it, there it opens on a dark looming sky. I believe there's like thunder and lightning, and the camera comes through the window to show the desk that I described earlier. And as a film school grad myself, my first question is, how did that shot come together? Like, how did you guys make that shot? So I'm happy that you shared a little behind the camera magic there.
Yeah, he's actually given me a VFX breakdown of that entire sequence. In fact, I think he's given me about 5 minutes of VFX breakdowns for other stuff he did in the film too. So at some point, I'd like to put that out there, because I did do that for the work that Santino did on Flatwoods as well. So he's kind of, you know, like Santino's going to be like a Spielberg level sort of like film genius, I think. And if you're interested in his work, he's got some other stuff on Vimeo. He made a short film called Health Class. Health is spelled H-E-L-L. Health Class. And he made that last year. And like, he's just he's exceptionally talented. And he's, you know, like his style on this stuff has really meshed well with what we were attempting to do on each film. You know, like, he's always loved stop motion, so he was a perfect fit for Flatwoods Monster, and he likes building sets. And he also modded out the werewolf mask that's used in this movie. This is a $5, literally, it's a $7 Amazon bought werewolf mask that's in the film, and then it was modded out, you know, to a pretty insane degree, including like they built a bodysuit to go with it and stuff like that. But it was all done for around $45.
That's,
I want to say.
Sorry, it's funny. Yeah. I actually had that as one of my questions. Mm-hmm. I was so impressed by the mask work and one of the reenactments that I was going to ask you. Like, you know, how much did you? I didn't want to ask how much you spent on it, but where did you get this puppet? I thought it was a puppet. It looked really good.
So I've got a lot of funny stories about the entire costume sort of saga that went on behind the scenes on this movie. Originally, we hired one person to do a costume for the film. That costume was made at a pretty high cost point for us. I'm sure for the guy that made it, he would consider it a low, you know, like kind of a low ball. And I get it, but like for us, it was pretty high, and we got it, and we attempted some shots with it, and it didn't work at all. Like, it wasn't even remotely going to work. So we pulled that out, and then Adam actually put me in touch with a buddy of his that he used to make horror films with down in Alabama, and he thought he would probably work with us on a pretty good, you know, like on a budget. But this was getting really late in the game. Like, I want to say we would have been talking to this guy around last June, So it was like we were getting down to the wire in terms of like needing to get this costume stuff done. And you know, we talked to him and he gave us a price, and I was like, we can probably make that work, maybe. But we were also going to have to drive to Alabama and do fittings and all this stuff, and it was getting too late to pull it off. So there was a night where, again, a lot of the stories with STM behind the scenes involve us sitting in like a Denny's or something talking. So we were sitting in a Denny's one night, and it was Zach, Jason, myself, and then Santino. And Santino thought we could make a costume store-bought work. We just needed the right kind of costume. So we actually went on Amazon while we're sitting in this Denny's, and we picked out a mask that cost $7. And we modded that mask as soon as it came in, pretty much. And then Santino built this bodysuit. Jason is actually in the suit, and Jason is probably the smallest member of the STM crew. So that's also kind of comedic. Like, if you know who's actually in the suit, it's like, you know, it's probably the least sort of physically imposing member of the crew. But he did like a great, he's like a huge horror movie fan. And I think he actually did like a really good job in the suit, and he had a lot of fun wearing it and stuff. So it definitely, it works in this movie far better than we thought it would. Especially, there's a couple shots in it that I think are actually really, really, really cool. And I say that as, you know, like, I'm the director of the movie, but I'm also just part of the crew when it comes down to it. And when we were filming them, a lot of the time it was either Zach or Jason or Zach or Santino that were actually doing the filming. So like, you know, like I'll get home and look at this footage and it's almost like seeing it for the first time. Cause I, you know, I wasn't the guy behind the camera. And, in this case it was really cool to see some of these shots, you know, come together. The backlit sort of stuff was something I really wanted in the film. Like the foggy backlit shots. I was watching John Carpenter's The Thing sort of religiously over the last 6 months for some reason.
I can see the influence there, actually. Yeah, now that you say that, yeah.
Yeah, it definitely got incorporated into that, the look of the monster in some of those shots. Especially the other thing, the reason the mask works so well is because of the eyes. And the eyes are just reflective bicycle tape.
Brilliant.
And yeah, and then if you shine a light on that, it reflects it naturally. So we were trying to stay away from any sort of like in camera, or not in camera, but any sort of like post production sort of CG or anything like that. And we really thought if you could pull that off, that look off of sort of having naturally glowing red eyes, it would be really unnerving. And actually, like, if you watch some of the unedited footage, it's even creepier than the way some of it ended up in the film. Like it something about the way that light reflects off that the tape, you know, like, and you're just seeing the outline of that mask. It's really kind of unnerving.
And speaking,
yeah, the music too, by
oh,
the way,
yeah, let's you, touch on you that. Had mentioned, yeah.
Yeah. Cause you had mentioned the music, and I did want to say, like, I think Brandon is a huge fan of this band Under Oath. And he came to me very early on and said that he had an opportunity to work with Chris Dudley, who's, I guess he was the keyboardist in that band. I wouldn't know. I've never actually listened to them. But he was the keyboardist in this band, and Brandon wanted to bring him on for this one. So they actually split the score duties on the film. But Brandon was definitely sort of steering that ship. And I think the score is just so different from his other scores because, you know, there isn't, Flatwoods has this very like melodic, you know, there's a lot of like themes going on. It's very melodic. It's fun to listen to. And this has a very like unnerving sort of creepy vibe to it. That isn't exactly pleasant at times. Like it really can get under your skin. And, Brandon did something over the weekend. He was scoring some short film that had like a sort of jazz influence. Like there were all these jazz instruments I was listening to. And that was interesting because he can switch up, you know, what he's sort of working with, and he can change the vibe of a film with the music to such a degree that it's really surprising. Like if you watched one of our movies without his score, it's a really interesting evolution to watch it go from not really having his score in there and just sort of watching it with the temp score to actually having his music in there, because he does such a good job with
it. Yeah, I can definitely see how it adds a dimension to the film. When I was at Crypticon, I got to hang out with Linda Godfrey for a little bit on Friday night, and that woman is amazing. Tell me a little bit about how she got involved and what she meant to the production. If she wasn't involved, would there even be a production of this film?
No, there really wouldn't be a Brave Road Beast film if not for her. I actually met her for the first time last September at Lauren Coleman's convention in Maine. Mm-hmm. And she was one of the speakers, and I told her at that event, like, you know, like, we want to make a movie about the Beast of Bray Road. I said, I'll tell you up front, I don't have any intention of making this unless you're involved. So I said, if it's a situation where you're not interested in being involved, or it's one of these things where you're kind of, you know, you're going to come in and do like a 20-minute interview and you don't want to spend time with us, that's totally fine. We're still probably not going to make that movie, because this really, I needed her in it like I needed Lyle in Boggy Creek Monster, or Jeff Wamsley in The Mothman of Point Pleasant. Like, she was going to be the title character, or central, not the title character, God, the central character that sort of carried us through the entire story. And the interesting thing about that is, like, in retrospect, if she hadn't been involved, there really wouldn't have been a movie, period, because so many witnesses dropped out during the production of the film. You know, at the end of the day, it's kind of Linda's movie. Between her and John Fredrickson, you've got all the sort of key points of the original, you know, late 80s, early 90s Beast of Bray Road sightings. So she was vital to the entire film actually happening. And she adds such an interest. She has such an interesting presence and sort of a different type of person than has been in any of our other films as well. So I feel like this is the one where people are really noticing that central character, unlike they have on some of the other films. And I know people love Jeff Wamsley and Lyle Blackburn and that stuff, but this is one where I keep hearing over and over how much people like Linda and are interested in Linda's story. So I'm really happy about that, actually.
Well, she's a great storyteller, and she's knowledgeable. She knows this stuff. She basically, I don't want to say she created it, but she discovered a lot of this stuff. So, you know, in the same way that that you interviewed Ed and Fred May for Flatwoods, without them, I feel like that film wouldn't be the same way. So, you know, I definitely agree that without Linda, this film just wouldn't be the same, or, you know, possibly exist, according to, you know, what you're saying there.
I mean, and it would have been the same way with Flatwoods, actually, now that you said that. Flatwoods was like one where that originally was supposed to be a YouTube episode of Case Files, and when Ed and Fred May came on, then it kind of became something else. But yeah, you're right. She's the key to the whole thing.
So, you know, speaking of Wisconsin and my terrible segues, I'd always heard a rumor that Bray Road was a gated road, that they did their best to keep everyone off. But from the film, it looked like you guys had easy access to it. What's the situation up there?
No, I mean, there's no way that road was ever gated. There's too many crossroads. I think there's a handful of roads. I'm saying that because it's the line in the movie, but there's a handful of roads that cross its path, Brookwood Lane, Hospital Road, and one other one. So, I mean, there wouldn't be any way to really gate that road off. There's tons of houses along it. You know, it's in clear sight of two major highways. It's not a scary road either, is the other thing. I keep sort of telling people this, you know, like, there's something unnerving about it, or kind of off about it after a while. But that's kind of what's weird about it to me, is, like, you know, like, at first blush, we all repeatedly kind of talked about how mundane and dull that road is. You know, you grew up in you know, the Cambridge, Sulphuric area, and I grew up in Bolivar, and in Bolivar, there's some really creepy farm roads, you know, like you're driving around in the middle of nowhere late at night that are genuinely creepy. That is not Bray Road.
It looked pretty wide open. Like
it's wide
open. Farming
communities. Yeah, and you can see houses pretty much at any point. You're going to be able to see a house, and you can see the highway. Pretty much the entire stretch of 6 miles of road, you can see the highway off to the one side, and for the first couple miles, you can see the highway running on the other side. So, you know, you don't feel isolated. You don't feel like it's even all that rural. So that's kind of weird about it. But there is something unnerving about it that sneaks up on you after a certain amount of time there, which is strange. You would think it would go the other direction. You'd
get
you know,
used
like
to
initially,
it.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that's not how Bray is. There, it's a strange. Yeah, it's not gated off. You could go there today, but I don't know what to tell you to look for because there really isn't much to see on the actual road.
Well, you know, let's dig a little deeper into that. As far as this creature is concerned, and of course we're talking about the, you know, I guess a dogman type creature. Is there anywhere for this thing to hide that could go undetected? I mean, from the looks of things, it looked like it was mostly, you know, corn and maybe soybean or something like that with a few tree lines here and there. But for the most part, it looked pretty wide open and flat.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to say I don't think there's a location there where something could live. You know, something sort of traveling through the area could probably hide out in some of those farming patches. So, you know, like most farmers' fields have patches of woods around them.
Yeah.
And it's like that on Bray Road, but they're not, you know, it's not like a huge patch of woods where something could sort of make a home for a while. I don't foresee that being the case at all. You know, and the Beast of Bray Road sightings really only took place over a few years, in the late 80s, early 90s. Now there have been occasional sightings here and there since then, but there was a span of time there where there were a lot of sightings around the area. But as far as Bray Road itself, I do not see anything living there. It wouldn't go undetected for very long, especially with, you know, all the farmers living around there who are usually, you know, keeping an eye out for any sort of large predatory animals that might take down livestock. So I don't buy into like there's some sort of undiscovered species of wolf-like, man-like creatures that are living in that area, because it just doesn't, I mean, biologically, that doesn't make a ton of sense to me, but it also doesn't make a ton of sense to me that they could find a place to hide out on that particular road.
Yeah, yeah, unless we're talking about something that's not biological, of course. And you touched on that in the film several different ways, bringing in the occult and some, like, Satan worship and stuff like that. And there was one particular story, and I don't know if you want to discuss it on here or you want to save it for the film, but it was an encounter in the 1930s mm-hmm. that took place. Is that something you want to touch on, or would you rather
save
that for the film?
I mean, that was my favorite story, and it was one that I actually really excited me about having in the film, and it was kind of one of the ones that made me decide that this was definitely going to be the movie we made next, because it's a historical account, which I love, but it's also kind of creepy because of the setting. The story you're referring to took place in, I believe, 1936 at a place called St. Coletta's in Jefferson County. Jefferson County is an adjoining county to Walworth County. I'm not sure the exact distance from Elkhorn to St. Coletta's. I know the drive took us 55 minutes to get from one place to another, but, you know, you're kind of driving around in the middle of nowhere, so mm-hmm. those back roads tend to run that way. St. Coletta's is a really creepy place. It's abandoned now. It's a closed down mental asylum. It's a good size. It's about the size of like a small college campus.
Okay.
So it's a big location. Back in the 30s, it was surrounded by these Native American burial grounds, burial mounds. I'm sorry. That's kind of important, actually. So there was a night watchman who was working the grounds one night, and he was wandering around the grounds, came around this corner, and there was a creature up on one of the mounds digging. And he said it was a dog-like, man-like thing. He said it stood on its hind legs and sort of started walking toward him. And as it was coming toward him, it was making this sort of moaning or growling noise that he later sort of connected to being maybe some sort of proto-human language. This is late at night. He's got a flashlight on this thing, and there's a dog walking on its hind legs talking to him, you know, like approaching him after digging in some sort of Indian burial mound. I mean, the entire setting is like ripe for some sort of horror movie.
Oh, it's perfect. He takes a swig of his flask and, you know, rubs his eyes kind of situation.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be great. According to him, as it was coming toward him, it was making this noise. He later told Linda Godfrey what the noise was, and she realized what it was actually saying the word Gadara. And Gadara was a town in the New Testament where Jesus cast demons out of a man who was in a graveyard that went into a herd of swine, and the swine ran down and leapt off a cliff into, assumedly, the Sea of Galilee. But that it's an interesting connection because of the fact that later in the movie we get into all this occult sort of hypothesis as to what might be, you know, the cause for the Beast of Bray Road. And here you have an account of a creature in 1936 that's saying the name of this town that's connected with a demonic possession case. There's also a case that had taken place a couple weeks prior to that. And it didn't involve a dog man, but it did involve a priest at St. Coletta's performing an exorcism on one of the patients who would have been a child at St. Coletta's. And he felt that whatever he had cast out of this child ended up following him around. So I don't know if you want to make a connection between the two or not, but it is interesting that, you know, you had this weird dog man encounter taking place in the 30s, and then later in the 80s and 90s you find out that there was all this sort of occult activity taking place around Bray Road right around the time where all of a sudden people start seeing some sort of upright walking wolf like creature again.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, at the best a coincidence, but there's, you know, a lot of connections here that could be made. Whether or not they should be made, it's another question, but they definitely could be. Well, let me move on to my last couple questions here. As far as the town of Elkhorn's concerned, it seemed to me that they had no interest in embracing the culture of this legend, you know, like Mothman does, or there's now a Flatwoods festival again. Well, you guys have Minerva Monster Day as well. Do you think that that'll change at any point, or are they pretty set in their ways that they want nothing to do with this and they don't think that it's a lucrative venture to take on? Or what's the situation going on up there?
I mean, they have nothing to do with the Beast of Bray Road. There's no, there isn't even a gift store in town that sells Linda's book.
Oh, wow.
There's nothing. There's no hint anywhere that you are in a place that is sort of more renowned for its local legend than anything. I don't know if they don't understand that is the case, or if they're genuinely, they don't care and they don't want any part of it. I don't know what the deal is. You know, like in our movie, one of the Brays says he doesn't think it has any commercial value.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, they couldn't be more wrong, but that's the way, you know, that's the way they're perceiving it.
Yeah.
So,
well, I make my living off of weird stuff, so I can tell him right now he's dead wrong.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They, you know, there are people that travel to that area just to drive down Bray Road, you know, who would love to go into some sort of, you know, look at it as some sort of, like, exhibit or, like, you know, like
guided a display, tour.
A display stand in the local city hall with, like, some newspaper articles would probably become a big thing, because there's nothing else in town to sort of even lead you to believe you're there. But,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't see it changing just based on the sort of attitude toward it that we encountered. Now, obviously, I could be wrong, and these things can change. I mean, Minerva, you know, well, to an extent, Minerva still doesn't really want anything to do with the Minerva monster. But it does take sort of the right person coming in and I guess opening people's eyes to what, you know, what can actually happen when a town embraces its local monster.
Well, hopefully we have a listener out there in the Elkhorn area that can head up this mission and get us something set up over there.
Yeah. Yeah, it should. I mean, there should be something. It's kind of mind-blowing. I've always said when it comes to these stories, like whether or not, you know, there's a physical reality to the monsters is kind of irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Like it's a piece of that town's history, whether they accept it or not. It is like it's actually one of the biggest pieces of its history, whether they realize it or not.
Yeah. Well, you look at a town like Rhinelander, which is also in Wisconsin, that's embracing
Hodag.
The Hodag legend. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, an admitted fake. So, you know, mm-hmm. obviously this stuff works to an extent.
Yeah.
Hopefully an entrepreneur gets the idea and gets the funds and puts it all together at some point.
Yeah, because small towns are going away, guys. Like, that's the unfortunate reality of America today, is that small towns are drying up. Mm-hmm. And we were just in one over the weekend, Lawndale, where the sort of infamous Marlon Lowe Thunderbird attempted abduction supposedly happened back in 1977. And, you know, like, I had this really interesting discussion with a guy that lived there. He actually came flying at us on he was wielding a cane and riding around on a moped. But he he told me that at one time that town, Lawndale, had 4 grocery stores, 3 gas stations, and a dance hall. And today there's one road that goes through it, and there's no gas stations, no grocery stores. And the one local grain elevator that's there, that's sort of the big local employer, is apparently going out of business. So, like, you know, like if we can find, not to get us horribly off topic here, but like,
no,
the point is, if a town can find something like that, that, you know, that would help it attract local attention. I'm not endorsing hoaxing. That's not what I'm doing here.
Sure,
I'm saying
sure.
like actually embracing the history of these stories and realizing that there are people who might not care as much about some of the historical events that have gone on in the area, but who would come around to something like a local monster legend. You know, like if these small towns will embrace what they've got, it can literally act as the lifeblood for those towns, like it has for Point Pleasant or Roswell.
Yeah. Well, you know, this kind of actually is a good segue. Of all the places that you filmed, and you've been to New York, West Virginia, Arkansas, and now Illinois, a bunch of other places, what's the most terrifying experience you've had filming? And it doesn't have to be paranormal necessarily. You know, did you have the guy with the moped and the cane? Was perhaps he the scariest guy? Like, have you ever, you and your crew, have you ever stumbled on anything or experienced anything and, you know, you thought to yourself, oh, we might be in trouble here?
So, I haven't been terrified. Like, I haven't had a terrifying experience. But I was filming on the trail of Bigfoot back in June in Oklahoma. And I was in a place called Area X, which is in the Ouachita Mountains. It's actually kind of in a valley. It's Area X is 9.5 miles off of any sort of major paved road. Hmm. It takes about 2.5 hours to traverse those 9.5 miles because of how bad the roads are.
Yeah.
And it's not a place where people are, where I was. I was in there with the North American Wood Ape Conservancy, and I was in there for 2.5 days sort of documenting what they do. And on my last night there, I'd just gone to bed in a tent. Again, we're in the middle of nowhere. You don't even really see planes in there. It's actually it becomes very claustrophobic, weirdly enough, after a while. Even though you're out in the wild, you start to feel really penned in, and you are so far from civilization that it becomes kind of unnerving. But on that final night, I was laying in bed late at night. It was around 3 o'clock in the morning, and something came, a rock actually came crashing off the side of this mountain, or I guess large hill that sits next to the camp, and slammed into the metal roof of this, what they call the hooch, but it's basically just like one of those big metal garages or outbuildings that they built there.
Okay.
Basically something had thrown a rock. It came flying off the hill, slammed into the top of that. And then as soon as it did that, it let out this really loud hoot and then a sort of laughter sound. And when I say hoot, I don't mean like an owl hooting. I mean like sort of a, like a whoop. Okay. And then this weird, the closest thing we could find that it sounded like was a gibbon laughing. And,
interesting.
Yeah. That's the only thing I've had happen to me out in the, you know, like on the filming that I immediately couldn't explain. It wasn't an owl and it wasn't a coyote. And, whatever it was big. Like just you know, like the night before we had had a armadillo like grunting around our tent, and those things sound like a bear. Like they can sound like a bear outside your tent late at night. And even having said that, this clearly was something with very large lungs. Like whatever is like the way I word it is, it's almost like when you watch those old John Wayne movies and they have the sort of Native American Apache or whatever let out a war whoop.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It sounded like that at the beginning, and then it became this weird laughter. And you know, it wasn't a bird, and it wasn't a coyote, and it wasn't, you know, a mountain lion, even though there are mountain lions in there. So you know, I'm left with not too many options as to what was in there, and it definitely wasn't a person. Because of where you are, to pull off some sort of hoax on the NAWAC, you'd have to probably be suicidal. They're all armed in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't really have a problem, you know, shooting if it's something that they feel like is a threat. So I just have serious doubts that a person could pull that off.
And their goal is to take a body. Is that not right?
I mean, their ultimate goal is to prove that Bigfoot exists by, you know, having a type specimen, and that probably means killing one. So they will do that if needed.
So, yeah, you'd have to be crazy to start yelling on that ridge, knowing that was below there.
Right. And what's funny is, like, once you're in there, that part of it doesn't even really cross your mind anymore. The idea that it could be people, because once you've actually gone back down there, you're like, oh, there's no, like, you'd have to drive 2.5 hours, and then you'd essentially have to live in the woods in hopes of pulling a prank off on this group. And it's bizarre. Like, it makes so little sense once you've actually been in there that the idea of it being a human being kind of goes away.
Yeah.
Because it just doesn't make sense given where they are.
And they don't announce their location either. That's why it's called Area X.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty hard to get to. So it's, that's the one, like, really strange thing that happened to me. We've had, you know, little odds and ends, but that was the only really crazy kind of thing that's occurred.
I'd say that's pretty substantial. I would love to have that happen to me, at least. That's what I say from the safety of my studio. When I'm outside, that may be another deal, but that sounds amazing.
Yeah, I can tell you, like, we were in a tent, and it was myself and my buddy Adam, and we were in this tent that we had set up outside of camp, kind of, you know, like, not far outside of camp, just like 20 yards outside of camp. You know, I don't know if we thought we were tough outdoorsmen, which we're not. But, like, things change the second the sun goes down in that place. And as soon as the sun starts going down, you're like, why did we set up the tent that far away from, like, everyone else? So, and there weren't that many of us in there to begin with, you know. So I never really had a safety in numbers sort of vibe. There was only, of the NAWAC, it was Kathy Strain, Bob Strain, Brian Brown, and Daryl Collier. So there's only four people plus Adam and myself. You know, so it was a strange experience. I don't refer to it as terrifying, though, because when it happened, it just, to me, I'd always expected some sort of, like, unexplainable encounter with, like, possibly Bigfoot to feel like an episode of Ghost Adventures or Finding Bigfoot, you know, where like, all of a sudden this crazy thing's happening and it's really creepy and all this. And there was nothing that was outright creepy about what happened. What happened to us was like a natural occurrence happening in some sort of creature's natural environment. That's all, you know, like hearing a coyote howl, you know, across a valley. That's basically what it was like hearing, only instead of that, you're hearing some sort of primate laughter after a rock is thrown. You know?
It sounds like your experience would have been, you know, expected in the Congo or something like that.
Exactly.
Some place where you know these creatures for a fact exist, and, you know,
yes.
Nothing's going to be throwing a rock in Oklahoma unless it's a human or, you know,
yeah.
a bipedal primate. So
that's it.
Crazy stuff. Well, I'm out of questions, but I do want to see if you'll stick around. I want to play a dogman encounter story. And if you're willing to stick around for a couple minutes, we'll discuss briefly afterwards, see what you think about it, and we'll go from there. Is that something you're interested in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Awesome. Okay, well, this call comes to us courtesy of Kaka Carrot Cake on YouTube. I didn't make that name up. And this is a encounter that took place in Wasilla, Alaska, back in 1998. So here's that call.
My encounter took place many years ago. I never had the faintest explanation for it until a couple of months ago when I randomly stumbled across Dogman on the internet. I was in my early 20s, working swing shifts at the time and commuting about 100 miles each way, so it was usually around 2 in the morning by the time I got home. I saw the monster, as I called it, on the northernmost section of Trunk Road in the Matanuska Valley in Alaska. This area is roughly smack in between the towns of Palmer and Wasilla. I was only about 10 miles from home at that point, so it must have been around 2 a.m. Trunk Road is a narrow two-lane road consisting of nothing but twists and turns. The surrounding terrain is somewhat swampy and thick with black spruce. It was late October, days before Halloween. There was no snow on the ground, but it was cold enough to be wary of ice. I was driving an 82 Subaru SW going about 20 miles per hour around a curve when my headlights caught a large, dark figure up ahead. I'm bad at judging distance, maybe 6 car lengths away. I instinctively let off the gas, coasting closer. At first I assumed it was a moose, as the area is infested with them, but no, it was standing upright. Bear then? No, not a bear. It looked so strange. Tall enough to be an uncommonly large bear, but far too slender, and it looked like it had spikes running down its neck and back. A Halloween prop? Odd but effective place for one. All those thoughts ran through my head in a fraction of a second. The car was still coasting closer and I could see more details. It was standing in profile, gazing across the road. I could clearly see its wolfish muzzle, large upright ears. The spikes on its back were in fact clumps of fur. Its spine curved in a smooth, very natural looking way. It was standing in the ditch, inches from the pavement. Because I was focused on its upper body, I don't recall anything about its back legs or if it had a tail. I did see its front legs, though, very doggy looking, hanging awkwardly down and slightly towards its front, exactly as you'd expect if a dog stood upright. It was perfectly still, and at this point, given the proximity to Halloween, I was quite convinced it was some sort of a Halloween prop because it was clearly not any kind of existing animal. I was deeply impressed and gently stepped on the brakes, intending to stop and examine it closely. Then it turned its head towards me. In the tiny fraction of a second that it took for it to swivel its head, I knew I had made a terrible mistake. The fluidness of its movement removed any and all doubt that this was some kind of a prop. It was horribly, terrifyingly alive. The pale off-white glow of its eyeshine and the headlights destroyed any possibility of a human in a costume. I think I sat there gaping at it in shock for a few seconds, the car barely moving by now, but still inching closer. As I was almost upon it, I think it could have leaned forward and touched the car if it had wanted. I had to look up to see its face. Again, I'm a bad judge of things, but I'm 5'4", and it was a heck of a lot taller than me. Tall like a polar bear standing. 7 feet? 8? I really can't say. I snapped out of my trance and slammed on the gas. The car fishtailed and I prepared myself for death by monster, as I was certain I'd end up in the ditch, but the tires caught the pavement and I drove like a complete maniac all the way home. I did not look back. I have only been on that section of road a few times since, never alone and never in the dark. For the next several years of driving that commute, I went 20-plus miles out of the way to avoid Trunk Road. The thing never made any aggressive moves, but there was something about it that felt very, I don't know, predatory. I never saw anything remotely like it again and never heard any stories about it in the area.
So, Seth, what do you think of that encounter story?
The description of like the spikes running up the back or whatever is really, really unusual. Like, it makes me wonder if it wasn't, I don't know. I the dogman subject is so bizarre to me because biologically a walking upright dog doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And it's always bothered me. It's one of the reasons I was so interested in like the occult / supernatural angle to the Bray Road Beast. So for me, I mean, when I hear these dogman stories, I never know what to think. Because we spoke to witnesses who clearly saw something that they didn't understand that sounds like it was the description that they're giving is just like that guy.
Yeah.
You know, like some sort of upright walking dog. And that doesn't make any sense. So,
and it seems like all the attributes to a majority of the encounter stories I hear are very, very similar. I mean, more similar than Sasquatch would be. Yeah.
Right.
That always throws me for a loop because I feel the same way, despite the fact that it's my favorite cryptid. It's also, in my mind, one of the least likely to exist for multiple reasons. One being, the physical makeup of it. And two, the location you see most of these, like you said, Bray Road's fairly populated. So I just have a real hard time with all of these, unless it's something else. Like you said, something occult related. Dare I say extraterrestrial or ultra-dimensional, something strange, something unearthly. But as far as this one's concerned, my thought here is this guy seeing a sick bear? Because it's standing up, probably to get a better look at the car that's coming. The spikes on his neck, on the back and neck, he later mentioned that it was matted hair. So it's possible it could have mange or something like that, and it just can't reach that part to scratch all the hair off. I don't know. Honestly, that's about the only thing I could come up with. Otherwise, the guy saw a werewolf.
When was that recording made, or do you know when did he say when his sighting happened? You might have said, and I just
yeah, it was October of 1998.
All right. It also sounds a lot like our poster. I mean, you remove the background and it's almost like he's describing our poster.
Yeah.
Which, like with the way the hair on the back's standing out and stuff like that, it's weird. But you're right. Like a lot of these sightings are of the same creature. And that's one of the things about it that's very unusual. I mean, even in Elkhorn, we were constantly coming back to the same sort of color and hair pattern, the way the hair grew on it, the way the eye shine was, the color of the eye shine. It all sounds like they're describing the same thing over and over.
Yeah, and it's been described eating something along the side of the road several times. Yes. I know I saw at least two encounters in your film that that was mentioned.
And we left one of, there's a big one that isn't in our film, but hopefully eventually if we can do some sort of follow-up, we can get to you. But there's all sorts of these roadkill eating stories.
Yeah. It's interesting stuff. Well, hey, Seth, I've kept you on here long enough. Tell everybody where they can get their own copy of Bray Road Beast.
DVDs are available through shop.smalltownmonsters.com. And the movie will be streaming on Vimeo On Demand, Amazon, and VidiSpace. So it's actually, if you're hearing this Friday, it's already out on Friday.
Awesome. And I highly suggest everybody go check it out. And not only this film, but go check out all Small Town Monsters, other films. I don't want to be as guilty as the other folks. Go check them all out. I tell you what, each time I think I have a favorite, a new one comes out, and now I'm forced to make Sophie's Choice, basically. They're brilliant. And if you're interested in this, and if you're not, why are you listening to the show? But if this is something that interests you, I guarantee you, you're going to have a great time. The production value is high. The information's like spot on, and it's entertaining. So, I mean, what else can you ask for? It's definitely a must-see. So I want to thank you so much, Seth, for taking an hour and 20 minutes out of your day to sit down and talk to me and the fine folks out there. So thank you again for coming out. And if you have any last words or anything you want
last
to plug,
words.
Now's your chance.
You know, I mean, just watch the movie, support it, tell your friends. If you like the movie, feel free to review it on Amazon and keep an eye out for Terror in the Skies on the Trail of Bigfoot and Momo coming out in 2019.
Momo.
And if you back Kickstarters, the Kickstarter for Terror in the Skies and Momo launches on February 7th.
And I'll be completely transparent. I haven't backed the Kickstarter yet, and I don't know why. I just haven't done it, but I'm going to from now on. And I highly recommend everybody else, you know, at least look into it. At least to get your name in the credits, which is pretty cool. So you know, check out the Kickstarter. I'll be sharing that on all our social media when that launches. So just keep an eye out for that. Thank you again, Seth. I truly appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks, man.
And that's going to do it for tonight's program. I want to thank Seth Breedlove for taking the time to talk with us this evening. And I should add that if you're a Patreon subscriber, I will have the full interview posted there by the end of the weekend, so you'll be able to hear his insight on a few strange happenings on the set of The Bray Road Beast. I also want to thank Addie Lloyd and Warren Pon Abbott for their contributions on this and every episode of Monsters Among Us. Monsters Among Us is written and produced by me, Derek Hayes. All audio used in this program is done so under the protection of fair use. And music from this episode was provided by Coag Music and Nature World 1986. Thank you all for listening, and until next week.